naked to mention that at the first of the session that Justice Heck is at a conference, but he will participate in the decision of these cases. Next cause is Richard Greenhall versus Service Lloyds Insurance Company from Travis County. Petitioner and respondent will each be allowed 15 minutes for argument. The petitioner will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Ray Chester will present argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court, I believe this case presents the following issue for decision. When a jury returns a punitive damages award that is supported by the evidence but is higher than requested by the plaintiff, does the trial court abuse its discretion in granting a post-verdict trial amendment when there is no showing of surprise or prejudice? The Austin Court of Appeals answered that question yes, and we respectfully submit that was error. I may digress for a moment. Petitioner Greenhall was the plaintiff in a bad faith insurance practices case tried before the Honorable Harley Clark here in Travis County. The jury returned all liability issues in favor of Mr. Greenhall, awarded him less actual damages than he sought, but more punitive damages than he requested. After the verdict came in, Greenhall sought leave to file a trial amendment to match the jury's punitive damage award. Service Lloyds filed an unsworn written objection to the granting of the trial amendment, but put on no evidence and made absolutely no showing of surprise or prejudice. The trial court granted the trial amendment and entered a judgment for the full jury verdict. The Austin Court of Appeals affirmed the judgment in all other respects, but held that the granting of a post-verdict trial amendment to increase the amount of punitive damages sought is an abuse of discretion in all cases or as a matter of law. In so holding, the Austin Court cited and followed the two opinions by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals that follow the same rule. But the Austin Court completely ignored at least seven opinions by various other courts of appeals which are directly to the contrary.
In that regard, counsel, should the rule be any different for a variance like this on punitive damages than one for actual damages?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the reason that my opponents in this case are simply urging the rule of their rule apply only to punitive damages is because that way they only have to ask you to overrule four cases as opposed to the 10 that would have to be overruled if it applies across the board, which Rule 47 does.
Realizing that the Court of Appeals decision in this case focuses on the punitive damages issue, is there any court that has really drawn that distinction that suggests there should be a difference between a variance on punitive and a variance on actual?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals, I believe in the Burke Royalty opinion, had language which would broadly apply to all damages. I think in their later opinion in the Winn-Dixie case, they specifically limited to punitive damages, but punitive damages were the only question in both of those opinions. I think, Your Honor, in all fairness, a possible distinction could be drawn in cases involving actual damages which are subject to precise mathematical proof, such as in a personal injury case, the amount of medical bills or lost wages, because there you could get into a situation of waiver. You would know when evidence came in, the record that was over the pleadings, and the objecting party would either then be in a position to either object to the evidence or waive the issue, and I think that would be controlled by Rule 67. That is obviously not the case here.
Is it your position that the trial judge has discretion to go either way on this, but the appellate court should not disturb?
That's correct, Your Honor.
If in the absence of surprise or prejudice, there's no real guiding principles for a trial judge. That's just one of the things we let a trial judge do.
No, Your Honor. In the absence of surprise or prejudice, I think the trial court is compelled to grant the trial amendment.
That's what I was going to
say. In fact, I hope to convince you today that not only was the trial court correct in granting the trial amendment in this case, but that it would have been an abuse of discretion not to grant it on this record.
Isn't the prejudice, you know, given $20,000 prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, that's obviously the argument made by Service Lloyds in this case. They were surprised at the verdict. and they're prejudiced by having to pay the extra money. But I was respectfully urged that that's not what surprise and prejudice means in this context. I think that's best demonstrated by the 1987 opinion in this court in the case style Benavidez versus Isle Construction Company. In that case, the plaintiff first requested prejudgment interest after the verdict was in by means of a post-verdict trial amendment. This court held that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to allow the trial amendment in that case. Now, the defendant in Benavidez was certainly prejudiced to the same extent Service Lloyds is in this case. They found out for the first time after the trial was over that they were going to be liable for an amount greater than the plaintiff's pretrial ad damnum. But this court specifically held that there was no surprise and prejudice in that case because prejudgment interest does not require any additional evidence at trial, and in short, there's nothing the defendant would have done differently during the trial. The exact same rationale applies in this case. In opposing Greenhall's requested trial amendment, Service Lloyds was simply not in a position to show the trial court that it would have tried the case any differently with a slightly higher ad damnum. Admittedly, if the jury had come back with a $5 million punitive damage award, as contrasted with a request of $100,000, perhaps Service Lloyds would have been in a position to be able to demonstrate to the trial court that it would have done something differently during the trial. Perhaps it may have hired more or different lawyers, put on more witnesses, or one can think of any number of things a defendant would do differently in a $5 million case as opposed to a $100,000 case.
Well, clearly they would have normally hired more experienced counsel, would they not?
Certainly, Your Honor.
If it would have been a $50 million case, you would have put a lawyer who's tried a lot more jury cases than you would if you have a $50,000 case.
That's exactly my point, Your Honor. In this case, the final judgment that was entered by the trial court was less than 20% higher than the pretrial ad damnum of the plaintiff.
What standard would you ask the court to adopt as a variance?
I don't believe the percentage of differential, you can make a bright line rule based on that. That's obviously a big factor. I think the biggest factor, Your Honor, is in a case-by-case basis, is there something the defendant would have done differently during the trial had they had pretrial notice of the maximum amount that was going to be entered?
It's an abuse of discretion, but we have the honor of correcting it. The trial judge guesses it wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the trial judge should get the benefit of the doubt in the close calls and should be reversed under the abuse of discretion if he clearly errs on either side.
Is it a factor of, is insurance coverage a factor? In other words, if a different claim then goes into another level of excess coverage or if it's outside of the coverage limits?
I certainly think that could be a factor, and if that is a factor, which it was not in this case, it is certainly would be incumbent upon the defendant or the objecting party to put on evidence or somehow make a showing to the trial court of how that was definitely a factor and how that constitutes surprise and prejudice in that case.
Therein lies the abuse of discretion that you're alleging, that there was no such showing in this case.
Correct.
There wasn't a showing that they would have done anything different, and that if a trial judge just arbitrarily ignores the rule refused to grant the amendment without any showing at all that that would be an abuse of discretion.
That's correct. Now, McDonald's civil practice draws an interesting distinction in the area of amended pleadings. He divides them all into two categories. One, where it drastically changes the nature of the case by either adding new parties or new theories of recovery. And the second category is all other trial amendments. And perhaps there could be a situation under the first category where by trying to add an additional party during the trial, it would be such an obvious showing of surprise or prejudice, perhaps no evidence but would be required to successfully resist a trial amendment. But in all other cases, which would definitely include this one, it is certainly incumbent upon the defendant to make some showing when it is not intuitively obvious from the situation.
Do you advocate a bright-line rule that in a situation such as your fact scenario here, that the plaintiff has the right to amend his pleadings, his ad damnum, to conform to the jury verdict?
Yes, Your Honor, if there's no showing of surprise or prejudice.
And in particular, if it involves exemplary damages where the sky is kind of the limit anyway, kind of whatever you can talk the jury into. It might be different as to the actual damages where have some more experts on your side, you thought the damages were going to be higher than they might ordinarily be as a defendant.
That's correct, Your Honor. For example, in this case, the case was argued to the jury by Service Lloyds that the conduct did not rise to the level which would justify the imposition of any punitive damages.
What about the proportionality rule?
Your Honor, the first of all, the excessiveness of the verdict or the amount of punitive damages in relation to the evidence is not being challenged in this court. And I think that's what the proportionality rule is relevant to. Furthermore, any inability to compare the actual damages to the punitive damages can be just as easily laid at the feet of Service Lloyds, because not only did they not object on the record to the way the charge was put together, at the charge conference there was no disagreement about the way the charge was put together. And lastly, the conduct that gave rise to the punitive damages was found to have caused $8,000 in actual damages. So I think that you can assess the proportion. It's 16-1 in this case.
What about the statement of Burke Royalty that the Court of Appeals lied on, the statement that says when the court allows the plaintiff to file a post-verdict amendment increasing punitive damages to meet the jury verdict and then enters a judgment on that verdict, the defendant is injured? That statement out of Burke Royalty. Are we to overrule Burke Royalty? We were to find the abuse of discretion here? And no abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see any way around it. I think that Burke Royalty and Winn-Dixie have to be overruled in this case. On the other hand, if you go the other way, I think that you're looking at overruling 4, 7, or 10 opinions by other courts, depending on where you'd all
go. No opinions of our court.
No opinions of this court. However, that statement from Burke Royalty is entirely inconsistent with the Benavidez opinion. Because the
saying that we've already overruled Burke Royalty and Benavidez, that portion of them.
And
did we cite Burke Royalty on Benavidez?
No, Your Honor. Did not.
I guess it's in your brief. What particularly in Benavidez say speaks to this issue about overruling this portion of Burke Royalty? Do you have it handy or is it in the brief?
Well, I'm happy to address that. I don't mean to mislead you. There is no mention of Burke Royalty in that case, no discussion of Burke Royalty at all in the Benavidez opinion. But I'm simply saying that the logic of Benavidez is entirely inconsistent with it, because the final result in the Benavidez case was that the defendant was faced with a judgment that was over the plaintiff's pretrial ad damnum, and so they were certainly injured in the same way that the defendant was in the Burke Royalty case. I think that it's very important to separate the issue of is the verdict excessive on the one hand versus was anybody's prejudiced by the trial amendment on the other. If a jury comes back with a verdict that is more than the plaintiff asked for and too high in light of the evidence, that can best be fixed by either a remittiture or a new trial. But there's no need to try and buck 50 years of precedent on trial amendments if what you're really trying to do is fix an excessive verdict. In this case, the Austin Court of Appeals did not hold that this verdict was excessive. In fact, in a separate portion of the opinion, they specifically held that the evidence justified punitive damages. So I respectfully submit that for purposes of deciding the trial amendment issue in this court, you must assume that the evidence fully supports the jury's award of punitive damages. A brief word about Rule 47. I think that rule and the policy considerations behind it are easily harmonized with the rules regarding trial amendments. Rule 47 simply calls for the plaintiff to state the maximum amount claimed. In 99.9% of all cases, that will provide the defendants with a ceiling on their maximum liability. But in those rare cases like this one, where the jury comes back with an award that is supported by the evidence but is over the pleadings, you have to ask yourself, was the defendant prejudiced by not having pretrial notice of the maximum amount claimed? In this case, they were not. We respectfully urge that the Court of Appeals be reversed. Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Ben Taylor and Mr. Michael Phillips present argument for respondents. Mr. Taylor, hello.
May it please the Court, I'm here actually representing a number of amici curiae who've tendered for the Court's consideration a brief supporting the Austin Court's decision on the pleading amendment issue.
Do you also represent the respondent?
No, we represent only American Medical International, Inc. and a number of individual defendants in the case that we described in our amicus brief. We are in an identical position to the respondents in this case insofar as we were faced with an open-ended pleading for punitive damages. We availed ourselves of the special exceptions remedy under Rule 47, which has been briefly adverted to by Petitioner's Counsel. We listened to the evidence. We listened to the jury arguments for $3 million of punitive damages, which was the specific amount pleaded in response to our special exception. The jury decided that actually, the numbers came out to about $9 million. There's a lot of dispute about all the elections that were made, and we're not sure how that will shake out on appeal. But ultimately, a post-verdict amendment was offered and permitted, and we now suffer under judgment for over $4,400,000 in punitive damages, despite the fact that we specially accepted and the plaintiff was required to amend to specify the maximum amount claimed. Now, what I seem to have heard from Petitioner's Counsel is that perhaps if it had been as high a variance as $100,000 to $5 million, that would be an abuse of discretion and perhaps no evidence of surprise would be necessary. He also has argued that perhaps this court should launch into a case-by-case analysis of whether the variance is sufficiently high to show prejudice. I think that that would be a very bad policy, and it would also be inconsistent with the provision of Rule 47. The rule wisely provides, in order to prohibit newspaper publicity, the specification of specific amounts in your first file petition. But on special exception, the court has to require the plaintiff to come down with a number. We're asking the court to hold, as it has held in connection with many other rules of civil procedure, that Rule 47 means what it says. It means that when the plaintiff amends to specify the maximum amount, that is the maximum amount, period. This is not a case like Flores versus Fourth Court of Appeals, in which Judge Mazzi contrasted the definition in Webster's Dictionary versus Black's Law Dictionary. Every dictionary that I've looked at says maximum amount means the greatest possible number or amount. There are good policy reasons why the rule says that. Mr. Kronzer, when he proposed the rule, agreed that the defendant has a right to know the maximum amount claimed, that the amount pleaded in response to the special exception would constitute a limitation on the judgment if that's the basis through which it goes to the trial. Now, so far we haven't had a plaintiff's attorney try to use Birchfield and Rule 704, as far as I know, to get an expert, a social psychologist, to come on and testify, yes, I think I know, in my expert opinion, what an appropriate amount of punitive damages would be. Well, what is that opinion? And assume the trial judge overrules all the objections. He says $1 million. Well, at that point, service lawyers could stand up and say, we object, we move to strike that testimony, we specially accepted, we have a number pleaded that's not supported by the pleadings, we object. The court overrules the objection, he's committing error. The plaintiff could, of course, move for a trial amendment, and then a whole new set of rules kick in. But that never happened. There was never any specific evidence of numbers in excess of what was pleaded. There was never any jury argument for a number higher than what was pleaded in response to the special exception under Rule 47. So there was no notice at any time until the jury just came down with this number that nobody had ever heard of. That's prejudice and surprise as a matter of law, and we shouldn't have to prove that. But even if we do, I think the record establishes it as a matter of law. The record is undisputed that we filed and service Lloyds filed proper special exceptions. The plaintiffs in both cases were required to specify the maximum amount claimed. That amount is the maximum amount. Unless maximum amount is something that the jury decides, totally outside the dispute that has been made between the parties. Petitioner's counsel speaks at length about four cases which allegedly would have to be overruled by this case and 50 years of precedent. Well, I think the court ought to examine some of those cases before it assumes that there is some 50 years of precedent supporting post-verdict amendments. The Lavender versus Hofer case is complete dictum. The court held no punitive damages were recoverable. It was reversed on that ground by this court. But after saying the issue was moot, they say we think there was no abuse of discretion from $50,000 to $200,000. No real analysis, just say they think it's within the court's discretion. Allstate Insurance Company versus Kelly, the common law exemplary damages were stricken out of the case. Well, it's pretty easy to say that there's no abuse of discretion to permit a pleading amendment when the damages aren't recoverable anyway. The Dayton Hudson case has been misstated in petitioner's brief. That is not a post-verdict amendment case. There's nothing in the opinion that suggests it's a post-verdict amendment. The only authority he has directly in his favor is a 1976 no-writ case out of Tyler, called Irwin versus Worley, and that was from $5,000 to $30,000. Objections were made. The court's entire analysis is we don't think there's an abuse of discretion. Personally, I don't believe there is any discretion to violate what Rule 47 says. I think that all of the other rules, 63, 66, and 67, do not apply in such a way as to permit the amendment that was permitted in this case. If, however, the court determines that this is a test or an abuse of discretion case, the question is whether the judge had discretion or not. Excuse me. The question is whether the judge abused his discretion. I would cite the court to Downer versus Aquamarine Operators. The question is whether the judge acted without reference to the guiding rules or principles. Actually, it may say any guiding rules or principles. Well, we say that when special exceptions are filed and a specific number is pleaded as the maximum amount, then the guiding rule of principle is Rule 47. The court shall require the pleader to amend so as to specify the maximum amount claimed. There's nothing unfair about that, unduly burdensome about that, and particularly with regard to punitive damages, there are some due process implications of permitting a defendant to be subject to unlimited liability when he avails himself of a rule, gets a specific number, never hears an argument to the jury, any evidence to the jury in excess of that number. The jury picks a number out of a hat, and then he's stuck with it.
That's so is your contention that Rule 63 and 67, or 66, I guess, just have no application at all to a post-verdict trial amendment to increase or inform the damages pled with the damages obtained?
That is my contention. Benavides goes against me in part on that, but Benavides does not support what happened in this case. Benavides is a decision. It was authored by Judge Campbell. And the prejudgment interest that was denied in that case was under very special circumstances. The Kavanaugh decision came out the day after the verdict in the Benavides case. Trial judge denies leave to file the post-verdict amendment. This court holds it was an abuse of discretion. But it's so interesting that petitioner's counsel pulls out this language from Judge Campbell's opinion. Recovery of prejudgment interest does not require any evidentiary proof at trial. Now, I know, and as Judge Kilgarland has written a couple of years ago, that the requirements for recovering punitive damages have certainly been liberalized by the court in recent years, but I don't think there's any holding by this court that punitive damages does not require evidentiary proof at trial, at least of the underlying conduct and its...
Your position, then, does require us to write in an exception to our rules to accept post-verdict trial amendments. Not just the punitive damages, but for any kind of damage.
Well, my position, if you went all the way with my position, that would be it. I think that the easy way to decide the case is to apply and to enforce the policies and the proviso in Rule 47. All the court has to say is that when the defendant properly files a special exception and says, I want to know what I'm up against, I may be representing a defendant who has insurance, and there may be different levels.
How is that any different than the defendant who files a special exception to a global liability allegation, and then something happens near the time of the trial, covered by Rule 63, and an amendment is permitted on that? I mean, how are we going to differentiate between that kind of situation and the situation that we're in?
Judge Doggett, I think that could be differentiated because there's no specific provision in Rule 90, more generally on special exceptions, that absolutely requires the court to require a pleader to amend. Under Rule 90, you can specially accept and point out the defect or insufficiency, and then there is discretion for the judge to make a ruling. And of course, most likely that would have to be taken up on appeal and the court wouldn't entertain a mandamus on that. But if a plaintiff files an open-ended pleading and the defendant files a proper special exception under Rule 47 and says, I need to know the biggest number I'm looking at, the court doesn't have any discretion. The rule, of the language of the rule is clear and unambiguous. There is no discretion but to require the plaintiff to come down with a specific number. And if the judge won't do that, it's just a very particular rule that we're asking the court to enforce.
I hadn't realized that you were going to be making all this argument. I understand this wasn't your case, but clearly in this case there was no showing, in accordance with Rule 63, no showing against the post-verdict amendment.
If Rule 63 required that, notwithstanding what Rule 47 says, that's true. We have no evidentiary proof in the record. We have an objection.
If we read Rule 63 as it's written, you lose.
Well, no. If you read it without looking at case law that establishes that surprise may be established as a matter of law in given circumstances, if you interpret Rule 63 as saying that unless in a post-verdict situation, if there is no evidence offered for surprise, you know, that we'd be in bad shape.
Go ahead and finish that.
I think instead we're asking the court not to ignore what it provided in Rule 47. The remedy that the Supreme Court Advisory Committee and Mr. Pronzer recommended and this court adopted, that defendants are absolutely entitled to have a specific number pleaded as the maximum amount, and especially in the punitive damages situation, in a case like ours where there's been no suggestion in front of the jury that an amount larger than $100,000 should be awarded, or in my case, $3 million should be awarded, it is unfair and it completely eviscerates the special exceptions remedy that this court provided in Rule 47 if you just say it's an abuse of discretion test. And I don't think that the court can properly apply general language in Rule 63 in total contravention of what the protection that Rule 47 gives defendants.
Is there any case law from our court that supports your position? Are you relying, as the Court of Appeals did, on Burke Royalty or any other Supreme Court case?
Well, we do rely on Burke Royalty, and I think Burke Royalty is right because it more properly analyzes this as a trial by consent situation. The issue raised by the plaintiff's petition for a specific amount of punitive damages is anywhere between zero and the specific amount pleaded. And if there's no specific evidence in it beyond that, you have a problem that the rule only permits amendments at any time up to the submission of the case to the jury. The motion has to be made before the case is submitted to the jury, or else it's not permissible. The only exception would be trial by consent, in which case permitting the amendment would be harmless because you pretend it's in the pleadings anyway, if it was tried by consent. But no, I don't think this court has specifically ruled on the issue of a post-verdict amendment when, in my view, the surprise exists as a matter of law because, contrasting with the Benavides case, there's nothing that could have been done differently at all. The prejudgment interest is applied as a mechanical point, like court costs. Under Rule 270 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, after the verdict comes in, it is absolutely forbidden to receive any evidence on a controversial issue, and I doubt Petitioner's Counsel would concede that there's no controversy on the punitive damages. Once we get this bigger number, we are not entitled, and the rules absolutely prohibit us from putting on more evidence. And we say that in the interest of fairness and predictability and certainty, under the clear language of Rule 47 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, the defendant in Service Lloyd's case and the defendants in our case filed a proper special exception. The court required the plaintiff to amend and specify the maximum amount. We just got a number we never heard of, and it's not right for the trial court just to look at dicta in a bunch of questionable courts of civil appeals cases and say this is within my discretion. And I'd like to point out, if the court studies a lot of these cases, including two that came up during the advisory committee minutes, there was some discussion of and one was cited in the petitioner's brief, the Tom's Toasted Peanuts versus Duche. Well, after they sanctimoniously said there's no abuse of discretion, they went ahead and ordered remittiture down about $10,000 below the amount of the trial petition. So it's pretty easy to go ahead and say there's no abuse of discretion if you're not going to let them keep the damages anyway. Another case that has not even been cited that the plaintiff's lawyers fight against us all the time is this American Produce versus J.D. Campesini. There were no objections made at all to the trial amendment. So any holding that that's within the court's discretion is totally unnecessary in light of the failure to preserve the error. There are not any cases that have to be overruled. The cases that he have cited that specifically say or hold that there is it's within the court's discretion to have an upward amendment of punitive damages, they're either dicta or the Irwin versus Worley case is wrong and predates the amendment to Rule 47. We ask that the court affirm or uphold the Austin court's decision on the pleading amendment issue. Well, thanks for the court's attention.
Justice Gonzalez, I'm afraid that there was a little bit of...
Yes, Fred, did the respondents use a bone or a tan?
Yes, sir, they did. Your Honor, I had given Mr. Taylor 10 minutes of my time, but to call the question, continuing, I was not permitted to speak, but I think the court has an issue before it, unless you want to hear from me.
My understanding was the lights were going for 10 minutes. My apologies, I had no intention of taking the respondent's time in advance of what we're dealing with.
Does anyone have any questions here? Counsel for... All right.
You made the issues clear, Mr. Taylor.
Court is ready to hear argument on rebuttal.
I'll be very brief, Your Honor. I'm afraid there was a little confusion between us earlier when we were talking about the Benavidez opinion and Burke Royalty. I'm so familiar with this case that I forget that everybody doesn't have these cases at their fingertips. This court's opinion in Burke Royalty did not address in any form or fashion the trial amendment issue.
They just spoke to the prejudice.
They didn't even speak to that at all, Your Honor. That went off. Of course, that's the seminal opinion on punitive, what constitutes punitive damages. And I believe, if I recall correctly, they reversed the punitive damage award in entirety in that case. They never addressed in any form or fashion the lower court's holding on the trial amendment issue. So when I was referring to Burke Royalty earlier being against me and having to be overruled, I'm simply talking about the Fort Worth Court of Appeals opinion in Burke Royalty. If I could just address Rule 47 for a moment, it can easily be harmonized with the other rules without having to write a specific exception into Rule 63 and Rule 66, which obviously is being requested here. 47 simply requires the pleader to specify the maximum amount claimed. As pointed out in the brief of the amicus here, Justice Clarence Guittard, who was on the Rules Committee at that time, proposed language in Rule 47, which would say that the after special exceptions, the plaintiff would amend, and that amount would constitute a maximum limit on his judgment. Well, obviously that language was rejected either by the Rules Committee or by this court, and the final form simply puts a limit on the amount claimed. That was in no way contravened in this case. We never pled for more than our pretrial addendum. We didn't argue for more, but simply the evidence justified it and the jury awarded it. So those rules can easily be harmonized by following the precedent in our brief, whereas under their rule, Rule 63 and 66 would have to basically be rewritten. It's argued that the trial court abuses its discretion as a matter of law in granting a post-verdict trial amendment to increase punitive damages. Well, an abuse of discretion as a matter of law is almost an oxymoron. If the trial court has no discretion, they have no discretion. Let's at least be honest about our terminology here. What's being proposed is an ironclad rule. I think it's important to leave the discretion with the trial judge, and I can think of at least two good reasons for that. Number one, having observed the trial judge is in the best position to assess whether or not the objecting party was surprised or prejudiced. In other words, would they have done anything different had they had pre-trial as opposed to post-trial notice of the maximum amount in the judgment. Secondly, the trial judge is in a unique position to hear evidence of surprise and prejudice. Should
would, you that, would you affirm the trial judge on very slight evidence? Or how much?
Well, fortunately, Your Honor, that question's not raised by this case since there's no evidence.
We're raised for future.
I understand. I think that the distinction set out in McDonald's on civil procedure that I alluded to earlier is helpful in that regard. I think that in the types of trial amendments where new parties or new theories of recovery are alleged at the last minute, then yes, perhaps slight evidence would be enough. But when, as in this case, there's a very slight difference in the amount in the verdict and what was pled, then I think there need, and it's not obvious from the situation that the defendant would have done anything different, then yes, I think they need some pretty good evidence of settlement considerations or whatever else would have affected their decision.
Counsel, when I was a young lawyer coming along, the rule that I thought that most of us lived by, as you plead, so are you bound. And you've had two opportunities to plead. The first time you didn't say how much, and the second time you put a cap on it. And why shouldn't you be bound by the cap that you set?
Your Honor, that's a toughest question I could have been asked today. I obviously undershot the mark on this case. I simply underestimated the honesty of the service Lloyd's witnesses in admitting their conduct in this case and their total lack of remorse at the conduct, and that obviously affected the jury more than I thought it would.
Did the jury return more than you argued for?
Yes, Your Honor. I can only say that here we have a, if I may finish my answer, here we have a case where the evidence justifies the higher figure, but it's obviously over than I what I pled. So you have to, so if you rule against me on this point, if you affirm the Austin Court of Appeals, you will be giving Mr. Greenhall less punitive damages than the evidence warrants. I submit that the only way that you should logically do that is if the defendant had shown that it was prejudiced by the timing of the amendment, which it did not do. If there are no further questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the second call. The court will take another recess.
Please rise.